Chapter 7. The Mysteries of Duke Street.
I'm going to kill him. Mickey gripped the wheel, literally baring his teeth. Rose laughed. She loved winding him up.
Yes, he's a complete stranger off the internet. He wears black leather gloves and everything, plus balaclava. I'm going to his house, to his dungeon, and you're taking me there, so it's your fault.
Mickey's old yellow Volkswagen Beetle puttered through the city, heading north from the Powell Estate through Southwark, over the river at London Bridge towards Stoke Newington. Clive Finch lived on Duke Street, N16, just to the north of Abney Park. As they drove, Rose tried to explain their mission, slaloming down a hillside of lies.
This Clive bloke is a legal expert, and Mum says I've got to get compensation from Henricks, and he works from home, so I'm just going to see him and fill out some forms.
I'm coming in with you.
You are not, because I'm not a baby. You can just sit outside, and if he gets a bit creepy, I can whistle.
And I'll knock his block off.
You'll knock his block off, said Rose, and they both laughed.
Where are you from, 1950?
Pip-pip, old chap, said Mickey, in a posh voice, and they relaxed into each other's company as they drove across the Thames, bright afternoon light glinting off the grey river.
All the same, he said, calmer now.
Why can't you do this online?
Because he needs my signature. Then the forms can be processed first thing on Monday morning.
I have to, Mickey. I've got no wages. I've got no savings. I've got nothing.
That seemed to settle it. Mickey began to talk about the summer. Maybe a holiday, just the two of them. Maybe Europe. Maybe interrailing. And Rose congratulated herself on a great lie. The doctor was the most exciting thing that had happened to her for years, and she liked keeping him secret. Not just to avoid Mickey's disbelief. She simply liked having something that was hers and hers alone. She wondered what that said about their relationship. As her friend Shireen always said, worry about that tomorrow. Clive Finch had promised much.
The truth will shake you to the core.
She'd sent him a short, vague summary of her two meetings with the doctor, not mentioning Henricks or the plastic arm, just that she'd met a man who had fascinated her. But when she asked what Clive knew, he emailed to say, not online. People are watching. This stuff is so secret and confidential. I can't risk it leaking. Seriously. The evidence I've got, I won't send at Hatchman's. You'll have to come to my house and see it for yourself. At that point, Rose had almost given up. Nice try, she replied, and Clive had emailed with denials and protestations of innocence, adding, I'm not in it, boys. That had puzzled her for a second until she realised she was on Mickey's computer, emailing from his account.
That makes it worse, she emailed back, because Mickey's my boyfriend and my name is Rose.
A minute or so had passed, and she'd wondered whether to abandon this and join the laughter in the kitchen, but then ping, another email. She'd opened it, and a photograph had begun to download, slowly. Rose had tensed up, thinking, if I see anything pink, I'm reporting him. But the photo had resolved into a fully clothed Clive, smiling, holding up today's copy of The Guardian. He couldn't know the significance of the Henricks headline. And behind him, his kids and Caroline waving at the camera. Caroline had a flat, peeved look, as though she'd done this 100 times. Clive's message read, Look, it's me right now, to deal with the family. I don't think internet weirdos invite you to come and meet the family, do they? And just to prove that it's safe, you can bring your boyfriend. I don't mind. Fair enough, Rose had thought. And then his final line had reeled her in. If you've met the doctor, if you've actually looked into his eyes and heard the things he has to say, then you won't be able to let this go. Am I right? As soon as Clive Finch opened the door to number 1 Duke Street, Rose trusted him. He was smiling, beaming, clumsy. He managed to stub his toe on his own front door. And behind him, she could see his two boys playing on an Xbox. Late Saturday sunlight bleached the white living room walls through wide patio doors, a long, narrow green garden stretching away at the back of the house. Nice place, thought Rose. Nice family. Nice man.
You must be Rose, said Clive, a hint of northeast in his voice.
That's me, she said. And that's my boyfriend, Mickey. There he is, do you see?
She stood back so that Clive could see Mickey sitting at the wheel of his bright yellow car. Mickey glowered.
He's going to wait outside in case you try to kill me.
Don't worry, called out Clive, giving Mickey a cheery thumbs up. No murders.
Well, you better not, said Rose, because I'd knock your block off long before Mickey could get here. Is that understood?
Perfectly.
Clive gave a little salute and stepped aside to let Rose in. She gave Mickey a final glance. His glower was almost rippling with heat now. And then closed the front door on him. As she stepped into the hall, a woman's voice called out from upstairs.
Who is it?
One of Dad's nutters, yelled the oldest boy.
Clive looked mortified.
He's just joking. Sorry. Michael, behave.
Oh, don't worry, said Rose. After the day I've had, I feel like a bit of nutter.
Well, come on. Come through. I've got all the stuff. It's in the shed.
Oh, that sounds a bit murdery, doesn't it?
Sorry.
Then he called upstairs.
It's a doctor thing. I might be a while. She's been reading the website. She might have evidence.
She? Called the voice, presumably Caroline.
She's read a website about the doctor and she's a she. Both boys on the settee cackled.
My lot are so funny, said Clive, giving the lads a pretend kick and a comedy growl as he led Rose out to the back garden.
And there it stood, Clive's shed, hemmed in by wooden fences on either side, in the curved shade of a laburnum tree.
The answers to everything, he said, are in here.
Mickey Smith kept on glowering, even though there was no one to appreciate it. Duke Street made him frown. Bay windows, neat, square front gardens, cars shining in the spring sunlight. Not wealthy, but richer than the Powell estate. It was quiet, on a Saturday afternoon. Everyone was playing tennis or bridge or chess or whatever. Mahjong, probably. But still, he thought, his bad mood ebbing away. Rose hadn't said no to France in the summer. They'd spent a few weekends together in Southend in a cheap B&B, but they'd never had an actual holiday as a couple. But now, if he saved up, they could go away for a fortnight, maybe even 3 weeks. Depending on a new job, of course, if she could find one. But if she couldn't, then maybe, yeah. It was time to ask her to move in. He was grinning now, his good humour restored by the one thing that always made him happy. Rose Tyler from number 143. When he thought of her, Mickey held one particular word close, like a talisman, and that word was lucky. Everyone else used that word too. Oh, you're lucky going out with her, said Patrice, said Mook, said Sally, and Mickey would laugh like it was a joke, but he knew with all his heart that it was true. He was going out with the only girl he'd ever loved, the first girl he'd ever spent the night with, the best girl he'd ever known. He didn't tell her that too often, of course, but he planned on having years and years to ration out the compliments. He remembered those terrible Jimmy Stone days, when she'd got bored and taken off with that louse, leaving Mickey with hollow bones. He could have raged, he could have shouted, he could have run off with Trisha Delaney instead. But Mickey had been so stunned that he'd done the best thing possible, quite by accident. He did nothing. He just waited. And when the Jimmy Stone storm had passed, Rose saw Mickey, still there, still faithful, still true, and came back. Luck beyond luck. And his luck had one truly strange and remarkable aspect, which bemused him every single day. His mother was long since gone, but nevertheless, she had known his girlfriend. Odessa Smith had once held the baby Rose in her arms. She'd smiled at her and kissed her forehead as though giving her blessing to them both across the years. I'm the luckiest man in the world, thought Mickey. And then he saw something move. He'd parked opposite Clive's house outside number 2 Duke Street and he thought he'd glimpsed something by the front door. Nothing now. The house sat still and silent. Front window, porch, azalea bush, a grey wheelie bin, which moved. The plastic bin jerked, bumped, and turned to face front. If a bin could be facing anything without an actual face, thought Mickey, smiling. He lifted himself up in his seat,
to see if a cat or a dog was nudging the bin, but there was no sign of anything. And then the bin jerked, shuddered, tottered from side to side, and seemed to make its mind up. It trundled down the path to the garden gate, big plastic wheels rumbling as it rolled. Then it stopped, bumping against the gate again and again, like a dog in a cage. Mickey was laughing now, because the lip of the lid on top of the bin did suggest a mouth, in a long, mean scowl. Anthropomorphism, he thought, like seeing a face in the moon. He got out of the car, chuckling to himself, because they were clever, whoever was doing this. Kids, of course, had to be. He looked for wires or strings, but couldn't see any. It was a freestanding bin, jerking and thudding against the gate, as though angry. A fleeting thought said, "It's hungry." But Mickey dismissed that and walked forward. "Where are you then?" he said to thin air. But no one appeared, and the bin seemed to be getting angrier. "Okay, I'll play your game." He opened the garden gate and gave a mock little bow to allow the bin out. But then he was chilled as the bin zoomed forward to execute an arc, curving around to face him. The animation was perfect. This couldn't be strings or levers or pulleys. It couldn't even be remote control, because the turn of the bin had been so fluid, so graceful, so real. Like something living. Mickey stared at the wheelie bin. It stared back. Even the tub of its body seemed to flex and contract, as though breathing. He flushed with anger. Many times in his life he'd said, "No one takes the Mickey out of Mickey." So now he reached out to grab hold of the bin, lifting up its lid to expose the child or puppeteer or motors inside. But the bin was empty. A black hollow. Mickey slammed down the lid and stepped back. Or tried to step back, because his right hand was now stuck to the lid. Superglue, he thought. He swore out loud. Oldest trick in the book. He pulled away, grimacing, ready to lose a little skin off his hand if he had to. But the plastic stretched, like thick grey toffee. A pizza cheese rope of plastic extended from the bin to his hand and then yank. The plastic pulled him back in. Mickey jerked forward, holding out his left hand to stop his head hitting the bin, and now his left hand was stuck too. He felt like an idiot, guessing that some kids behind net curtains were capturing this on a camcorder. £250 from "You've been framed, you little sods." But at the same time, Mickey felt absolute terror. Because the plastic underneath his hands was squirming somehow. It had heat. It had motility. It had intention as it flowed over his hands, up to his wrists. The bin was absorbing him. Mickey didn't care who was watching now or how stupid he looked. He was fighting to save his life. He heaved backwards, the gluey grey toffee plastic extruded out. He felt the plastic around his wrists tighten, but he pulled harder and harder and thought the extrusions grew longer, paler, thinner. Yes, he thought. Yes, if I can pull hard enough, they'll snap. So he pulled with all his might, the ropes of plastic stretching out a metre, 2 metres, thinning, about to break, but the bin was just playing with him. It yanked back its extrusions with one smart snap. Mickey stayed attached and lifted off his feet, flying through the air towards the bin. It opened its lid to swallow him. He plunged headfirst into the bin's body with an echoing scream, and the lid slammed shut. Then the bin stood still, inanimate, an ordinary thing on an ordinary pavement on a completely ordinary day. There was silence on Duke Street. Nothing moved. Then the bin's lid lips rippled as it issued the most tremendous, larruping, satisfied burp. And everything was silent and still once more.